Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about Square's attempt to expand their product offerings, Venmo's attempt to be profitable, Coinbase expands into trading and other investment services around blockchain, and it's the new versus the old in financial services providers with JP Morgan and Santander and all the big banks against the new providers. Who will win? Please hit subscribe to keep up with these and the latest in fintech news. Well, let's get started. Monica, thanks for joining us this week.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hi, good to be back.
All right, our first article this week is on Square. Are they going to take over the world, Monica?
Well, I think they're certainly going to try. So Square's CFO, Sarah Friar, was participating at Recode's Code Commerce 2018 conference this this week. And she was asked some questions about Square's expansion plans. And to give you a little bit of context, and this is probably a stat that we've mentioned before, but just in the U.S. alone, there are 30 million unbanked or underbanked households. So if you just look at the portion of households in the U.S. who don't have a traditional banking service, that already represents a pretty substantial opportunity for non-traditional banks.
So is that where Square is aiming for, the unbanked?
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I think Square would be perfectly happy to kind of cement their position as a vital service provider for small businesses. So it's not necessarily clear that Square is particularly focused only on the underbanked or unbanked households. You know, they're already a vital service provider for a lot of small businesses, and I think they'd be happy to expand wherever they could. What Sarah Friar was more explicit about was that Square absolutely does plan to expand into this space, and that they're looking at all different kinds of offerings, and some that she particularly mentioned might be some savings products, very similar to a banking account, or allowing customers to buy stock. Actually, Square already has $200 million in assets that are just kind of floating around. So when you think about the opportunity to provide more particular services for, you know, $200 million of other people's money, that's a pretty meaningful
opportunity.
It's
enough to get started.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you can also now get paid via Square, right? Like, I think they give you an ACH number, so you can actually get your paycheck.
Yes.
Into the Square Cash.
That's one of the things that we've talked about here. So I do want to share one of the quotes that that Sarah gave, which is, anything you do today with a bank account, you should look to the Cash App to begin to emulate more and more of that. So in this same area of kind of consumer-facing payment space, some news came out in the Wall Street Journal this week about what's going on at Venmo. PayPal, which owns Venmo, they've replaced the leader of Venmo for the second time in 2 years, and they have elevated Amit Jawar as the general manager. Jawar previously was acting as the operations chief of Braintree, which is also a subsidiary of PayPal. What's notable about this is the first time that Venmo has had a dedicated leader for the time that it's been in PayPal.
That's so kind of weird to see.
That is very odd. Yeah.
You know, Venmo's not some five-person startup thing.
It's not a fledging company. They do a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty huge.
They
and not to have a dedicated leader.
They did $14 billion in Q2 alone.
So maybe we should throw a body at that.
Yeah. So I think PayPal has started to recognize the opportunity here, right? They're moving a ton of volume through, but as a little bit of a running joke on our podcast, they are not profitable. They are currently losing money as an operating unit.
Yep.
So, unlike the previous heads of Venmo, Jawar's focus will be on Venmo exclusively. And this, paired with PayPal's really pushing Venmo integration with some services like Uber and Grubhub.
I just got an email today saying that if I use Uber Eats, they'll give me a $10 coupon.
Yeah.
If I pay with Venmo to get Uber Eats.
If you pay with Venmo. So they're losing money even a little bit faster with you.
Yes, but this article, which if I haven't mentioned is in the Wall Street Journal, this article says that Venmo has payment processing agreements with over 2 million firms. So if you think about their market penetration that's already out there, you know, there ought to be a way to monetize that. And there's one other little tidbit that I thought was, well, there's more than one tidbit that's interesting in this article, but some of which we won't get into today. But Venmo is issuing plastic debit cards for offline purchases for its customers.
In many colors, right? I think I saw this.
Oh, like pink, I haven't even seen the color choices.
Yeah, I think you can pick your colors now.
Well, it's hard to believe that millennials, their target audience, wouldn't want to be able to customize.
Ooh, shiny colors.
Shiny Instagram-ready card, absolutely.
And yeah. I say that with no shame because I remember when traditional banks started letting people pick the patterns on their credit cards and people go gaga for that.
I do.
Yeah. So more to follow there, but I guess at some point I'm probably going to have to get a Venmo account.
You don't have a Venmo account?
No, and it's been like a kind of a
You
point.
Don't have a Venmo account.
I know. And it's been a little point of like stubborn pride. Like, I'm so old, I'm sticking with PayPal.
Well, there's so
which
many.
Is a company, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting things with this article. It reads like a business school's case study, because mm-hmm. They talk about like these culture issues with Venmo and PayPal. They have an investment from a hedge fund mm-hmm. who's probably putting a lot of pressure on them to turn this into something much more profitable. Hedge funds aren't looking for these 2 and 3%. They want multiples of return back on
They're
their money.
They're not looking for a value investment.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that, they put $800 million in, so they're going to want billions out down the line. There's privacy issues. So, definitely a very interesting article. Definitely recommend you take a look at it.
Yeah. I actually think the privacy issues are something that Venmo is probably going to need to change some of its ways. Because if you are going to be a huge payment processor, you know what? Not everybody wants every payment publicized. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know that. Venmo automatically
No. You can
data?
Lock it on the app. You can make a transaction public or private. Mine are private by default, but I see like all my friends like drinks and rent and whatever on the app.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. What? Why would they make it public like that?
Because it's a social thing. The kids nowadays like it. They want to say, I went with Mike, whatever. I got drinks with Mike. Oh. I'm going to let the whole world know that I had drinks
Steve,
with Mike.
What is this bail bonds company all about? They take Venmo? That's
child support payments.
Yeah, right. What's this regular monthly thing? Oh, yeah, I didn't know it was like considered like a social thing. But, yeah, they did get their hands slapped, I saw. In the article they mentioned, because they didn't make the setting easy to switch to private.
It's not easy to toggle to private. No, it's sort of like the
maybe
Facebook,
it's easy now.
It may be easier now.
They got the regulators were on them, privacy advocates
maybe
were on them.
Maybe that's what they'll use some of that $800 million for, to code that.
To create a toggle button.
Well, yeah.
Private transaction.
I'll be happy to do that job for them then. Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Thanks. And our next article is on Coinbase. They've been expanding into institutional investments, and so they just made an announcement that they're partnering with a company called Caspian, which has a full stack of tools to bring additional trading and portfolio management capabilities. Now, Coinbase has been hiring a lot in New York, building up their institutional services. But they partnered now with this brand new company. This company, Caspian, didn't exist 3 days before they made this announcement that they were partnering with them.
That's incredible.
Well, that sounds to me like they had the germ and had been incubating it.
Well, it's not like Caspian is starting from scratch. They're a combination of two existing companies, one of which already has a lot of trading and risk management experience for traditional assets already behind them. So it's not completely coming out of nowhere. But guess how they're raising money?
On ICO.
An ICO?
They are issuing cryptocurrencies. That's right. Yeah, so they're offering Ethereum tokens with the token standard ERC20 on Ethereum.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what's
so that's for? the software protocol to issue tokens on Ethereum. So
I feel like they could really work on naming these things.
ERC20.
Can we just find some good marketing people to work with the nerds?
I don't think programmers are. Yeah,
acorns later, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right, the cool names end up coming up later.
Acorns later.
I love it.
So Caspian is a story, you know, in and of itself. And they're, you know, this is a big boost to get partnered up with Coinbase. Actually, it's Coinbase Pro. So it's, you know, they're institutional, they're high net worth investor kind of services.
So this will basically enable pro traders to use the Coinbase platform to trade on cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, right. And it also came out just today, I think I saw, was released that Coinbase is going to make it easier. They're lowering the bar, if you will, on adding new cryptocurrencies to their platform. So before, they were looking at the standard as being a worldwide compliance to be able to add, let's say, XRP, Ripple. But now they're taking it by jurisdiction. So if it qualifies for the rules in, I don't know, Liechtenstein, then they'll trade that cryptocurrency just in Liechtenstein. And so they're going to take it more by jurisdiction so they can move a little quicker, I think.
How quickly the legal world comes to crap on crypto dreams. I remember when.
It's all going to end up, everything's going to be fine. Just throw your money in there, no problem. So now you can actually submit a form saying that you want to have your cryptocurrency traded on Coinbase and for them to review now. So there's a place on their website where you can submit.
So how long till I can put half my 401k into a cryptocurrency?
You can do it into a cryptocurrency tomorrow. Yeah.
You just need to self-directed.
Yeah. All right. They do have cryptocurrencies already, so you can do that right away. So yeah, a lot of interesting things going on in the cryptocurrency world on this.
But it's definitely moving to more of an institutional space, which I think is a sign of maturation.
It is. I know that we talked about a few weeks ago about Goldman Sachs having the, you know, sort of the fake news stuff that happened weeks ago. So they're moving to the space. I wonder whether other banks will build their platforms in-house to trade cryptos, or whether they will go through like a coin or something. That's, I guess, TBD, but kind of an interesting question.
Build or buy, yeah.
Yeah, for now, at least Coinbase is partnering up. They're buying in. So what's the worst nightmare you can have if you're a large company and you build up some cool, new, cutting-edge software in your company? That's right. They quit and they leave and they form their own company.
Oh, yeah.
Which happens over and over again. And it's happened to RBS. Their blockchain division has broken off, and they're forming their own company and their own blockchain called Quorum, kind of like Coral Chorus, like working together smoothly. Friends, but not coworkers anymore, apparently. Okay, so what they're doing is they're creating a blockchain, an ecosystem for enterprises called Arkit. So similar to
I repeat Arkit? My earlier objections.
Naming people.
Like
it's Noah's
Arkit?
Smaller ark.
Well, it's ARQIT.
That does not make it better.
Patricia, David Arkit, sure.
Arkit.
Patricia Arkit.
Yeah. Good. No, I don't know where they got that name, but it's supposed to be a quantum resistant enterprise standard. So. With current computers,
buzzword.
Yeah, you can't possibly, you know, break the blockchain hash codes and the SHA 256 and all that stuff. But a quantum computer theoretically someday could. So they're already building that in, so they can detect if there's a quantum attack and then shut that down. So that it's not even giving it a chance. You know, if they see that something like that's coming through. So pretty interesting. Maybe it is all buzzwords to get some marketing and sound like they're on the cutting edge.
Well, but certainly, you know, quantum computing is something that is in its fairly early stages, and it's not really, from the little reading I've done, it's not really clear what its applications will or won't be, but certainly if we've learned anything over the last couple of years, is that no matter what the intentions of the creators were, any tool can be leveraged for good or for ill. Right. So it's good that they are thinking about ways to thwart the newest kind of attack.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe it's like a something they can develop over time, you know, as quantum computers come online. But that's theoretically the thing that could break blockchains and make it vulnerable just like everything else.
Kill it in its infancy.
So Quorum is funding their company by...
An ICO.
Yeah. Right. So they are doing a token sale based on the Ethereum ERC-20 token standard for...
Wait, isn't that what you just said about the other company too?
It's,
so everyone's doing ERC-20.
Everybody's on the ERC-20 bandwagon.
So Ethereum is feeling flush.
Yeah. So, yeah, I might be offering some Ethereum-based tokens. So they have their own tokens, but it's just based on this standard and running on Ethereum. So, and then eventually they say they're going to migrate to their own native coin based on this ARKit standard later on. So if you're, make sure you have non-compete agreements with your teams, if you're at a large company.
And if you're in a state or jurisdiction that allows them. California, for
That's
example,
right.
is,
well, they'll probably move somewhere.
Is notoriously supportive of employee rights, whereas Massachusetts is notoriously supportive of employer.
That's actually
rights.
An argument that I've heard for why Silicon Valley kind of took off, while the Massachusetts some highway name.
Oh yeah, yeah, one right, 128 or something.
128
yeah.
maybe, yeah.
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 So, interesting.
Huh.
This does not constitute legal advice.
Yeah. Consult a lawyer.
That's right. Well, I mean, RBS isn't the only one that suffered through this kind of thing. Amber Baldit left JPMorgan Chase to start Clover. Julio Faura and Ed Budd quit Santander and Deutsche Bank each, and they formed a startup called Adhara. So be nice to your tech-savvy employees. Make sure they have non-compete agreements. Generally give them what they want to keep them happy and interested in working for you.
Or, hot take, don't do that and let them go off and fund interesting good companies.
And invest in them.
And invest in them.
To go on their own. Yeah, right. That's the kind of like Google kind of approach.
Lots of ways for it to work.
Yeah.
So when are we going to launch an ICO under the ERC-20 protocol?
Every time you download this podcast, you get one token of the FinTech Newscast.
Which can be redeemed for... An Audible account?
about 25 minutes or more of... Pure entertainment.
Pure joy.
All right. So our next article is the new versus the old. Who's going to win in this slug out contest,
the
Monica?
Never-ending conflict.
Yeah. So I guess I was doing a lot of Wall Street Journal reading.
Every
this
year,
week.
I start to side more with the old.
Oh. Have you given any thought to why that might be?
Those young whippersnappers, they think. It's so simple.
Yes, I have an idea that it might be that you, as well as I, we're getting older.
Not me.
Steve's in denial. Okay. No one under 40 podcast.
All right. So we have talked many a time about how millennials are the largest generation in the U.S. And more and more, they are a slice of the pie that money managers are going after.
How big of a slice of the pie, Monica?
Well, I don't actually have today's stat, but I can tell you that according to the Wall Street Journal, in the next 12 years, millennials are estimated to have more than $11 trillion in assets. I don't have the number for today's millennial net value. But the Wall Street Journal does state that in the next 12 years, millennials are estimated to have more than $11 trillion in assets.
So I've actually heard that Gen Z, after the millennials, will be 32% of the population by 2030 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll have 40% of the assets.
Yeah. And
are they inheriting the...
Well,
it's the big transfer, absolutely.
Yeah, we are in the midst of beginning the biggest wealth transfer, intergenerational wealth transfer that the world has ever known. So that is certainly an element here. But also, millennials are, you know, the oldest millennials are, I think, in their mid-30s now.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've been working for a while. They're buying homes. They've got 401ks. They've got some assets.
I've heard the best way to make money is to inherit it or steal it. And the best way is for your parents to steal it and for you to inherit it.
Oh, God. No comment. But again, this is not legal advice.
We're not all. We can't all be Kennedys.
We cannot all be Kennedys or Trumps. So the question is, will millennials choose kind of an old school money management option or a new school? So on both sides, on the kind of new school side, we've got many firms, Wealthfront, Betterment, lots of them. They're basically robo-advisors. And part of their value proposition is that millennials are digital natives. And so these firms have online tools that are designed with a high-quality user experience
intuitive
in mind.
Design, great apps.
Absolutely.
The whole shebang.
And these firms would also say that millennials would actually prefer to do most of their investing research and checking up through online tools.
But it's not just online tools. I mean, they do have in-person and expert advisors.
I know for Betterment, you can definitely get an FA on the phone if you want. There's a plan where you can get an FA as well.
Also, if you just pay a little bit more, you get the personal.
I think you
both have to have an account minimum and you have to pay. I'm not positive, but you either have to have an account minimum that's somewhat more substantial than what it just takes to open an account with those firms.
10,000 maybe.
Yeah. That sounds about right. So on the other side, we have more traditional money management firms. Your Morgan Stanley's, your Merrill Lynch's.
Your Goldman Sachs.
Absolutely.
Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers.
All of them. Yeah.
Well, they're solid. They're not going anywhere.
No, not going anywhere. And some of these firms have actually created robo-advising tools as well. However, their account minimums typically are higher on these more traditional sides, as are the fees. And these kind of old school firms would say, hey, we actually think that the value of really solid technology and human advice is actually worth that premium.
It's like peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah. And they also think that that combination will be more powerfully appealing to millennials as they get older and their financial needs get more complex, which is something that usually happens. You know, you have kids, you might be taking care of your parents. All of a sudden, you need more things to kind of help you plan for your future than you did when you were 25. I, at least, have certainly found that to be the case in my own experience.
You will someday. So I wonder if the expertise of the the existing firms and all of their services, and like you said, they can take you through so many complex, they can handle everything rather than just an app, starts losing its appeal. The app starts losing its appeal as your wealth grows and...
That makes sense.
You need more services.
I saw a graph somewhere that sort of that highlighted the assets under management by Betterment, Wealthfront, Segfin, and the other. And they paled in comparison to Schwab, Fidelity, and the other players. So there's all this hoopla about this company sort of taking more market share and appealing to millennials and Gen Z and whatever. But
Betterment had huge ads around the U.S. Open.
All over
there's
the place.
There's huge signs.
Yeah.
Actually, around New York, there was a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
You would and should expect these firms with much shorter tenures of existence to have a much smaller piece of the pie. That doesn't necessarily mean it'll stay that way. And to John's point about, well, could the service that people use change as they get older? Absolutely. So just to give you a sense of some of the different account minimums, because I think this does speak to where you might go depending on what you need. Mm-hmm. Betterment has no minimum on a digital account. And Wealthfront has a $500 minimum. So if you were at all thinking that like, oh, it's time for me to get into this investing game, if you have $1 or $500, there's a lot of young people who can make that happen. However, both Merrill Lynch's Merrill Edge Guided Investing, great name, guys, and I know you have a marketing budget, and Morgan Stanley's Access Investing, they both have a $5,000 minimum. So that's a much taller order to get to.
I think it's the same with Schwab as well. They have a $10,000 minimum.
And that's even higher. And then you've still got another segment of folks in the market, and you have this at all ages. It's people who like to be their own advisor. So discount brokers have always served that market. TD Ameritrade, Schwab. But
Coinbase.
Now, and now you also have somebody pressuring those incumbents, Robinhood, right? So, hey, free trades. We all like free. Mm-hmm. And even JP Morgan is actually launching an app that will offer 100 free stock trades to account holders at its retail bank in the first year. Now, I have to say, I'm not sure how I feel about, oh, you've got 1 year to do your 100 free trades. But, you know, it's an interesting
model. Damn it, I've only done 95 trades. I'm going to do 5 more trades or else it'll be wasted.
Yeah. And there's no particular reason that the old and the new can't work together. So Marcus, which is owned by Goldman Sachs, they have an account minimum of $1. And they're mostly on the banking side right now. They have created a partnership with Clarity Money.
They actually bought Clarity Money.
Oh, well, then the Wall Street Journal just got fact-checked by Steve. Mm-hmm.
Latest update.
Clarity Money is an app that lets its customers view all of their financial data in one place and keep tabs on their spending and also, get this, see tailored offers for various financial products. Methinks that's how they make their money. But of course, this is very similar to Mint or Personal Capital, some things that already exist.
Is this where like 95% of people don't pay and they make all their money from the 5% of people?
I don't think the service premium is paid. I think Clarity is probably getting its money from the advertisers or affiliate fees of people who click through.
A tiny bit on a lot of people.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's my guess.
Yeah.
This will be kind of an interesting tension to watch over the next, this is a long battle, I would
20
say.
Years?
20, 30. I'm very interested to see how it all plays out.
So I want it through Alexa. I want to invest through Alexa right now.
Through Alexa?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't understand. Sell. So from your sort of, who would you bet on right now? Sort of the incumbents or the new guys?
So I'm not sure, but I do think that financial services, I think so much of it depends on, who are you, right? Are you someone who really enjoys doing the research and digging in and kind of making a plan for yourself? If you are, then I think the more self-directed and technology-enabled tools, they're wonderful for you. If you are someone who's like, oh my God, the last thing I want to do on a Sunday night is like research different index funds and figure out the optimum allocation strategy for me, then, it might be worth cobbling together $5,000. Yeah. And you can start with a robo-advisor, but like get your $5,000 and go get a professional.
Yeah. Well, I think, in the financial industry, it's been like these huge companies and them merging with each other and getting this massive scale. So maybe it's the old buying the new.
Which is actually, we've even seen a lot of...
It could also be the new joining with the new.
Joining with the old.
There can always be a new company, but it'll have to get up to a certain scale to compete at all. Because right now, they're burning through investor money to try to get up to that point.
I know that recently Sigfig changed their model so that they now provide white label services to banks and no longer do the consumer facing stuff now. So they see it as a way to make money from the banks to create that partnership and now just go to consumers now. So could be a model as well.
Pickles and shovels.
I think there are lots of models to look at. And, everything's great when the market's going up, right? It's, pretty hard to make terrible mistakes.
Some people manage.
Always. There are a couple of dynamics that I think are unknown. So on the traditional money manager side, there are a few funds, and I apologize, I don't necessarily know the names of them off the top of my head, but there are funds that, funds that hold a huge preponderance of all of the assets in that type of class of funds. So we are seeing kind of some immense consolidation in terms of some of the most popular funds in the marketplace. And then on the robo-advisor side, we don't really know what things look like in a downturn. We don't know if they are well equipped to kind of encourage their customers not to sell at the bottom and buy back on the rise, So we don't really know what it all will look like. But I'm sure it will be interesting. You can always count on that.
Yeah. Well, it seems like technology, you know, presents opportunities for new players, but then that technology becomes the baseline for everybody. High-frequency trading was this new, very cutting edge. People were laying optical wire to get, you know, millisecond advantages on each other. And now that's the standard for all of the traders.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that traditional money manager firms who are consumer facing, they are getting that sense. And
they'll have that robo-advising section.
They have to bring up their technology level. I'd be very interested to know what it looks like on the institutional side, like particularly for like your company's 401k firm. So last time I logged into my 401k, I always just want to like kill the site. It's terrible. It's not. It's Empower. Sorry, Empower. but you know, you think about, well, if you've got, you know, 2/3 of American adults who expect a much higher quality online experience, but of course, adults don't usually get to pick their 401k provider, right? Mm-hmm. Their plan administrators have. So it'll just be interesting to see what other ripple effects this our elevated standards of technology experiences.
Yeah. So for the new guys, improve your offerings and your expertise. And for the new guys, listen to your graphic designers once in a while. You have them already. Just listen to them.
Or even better, go to the Vanguard site and do the opposite of that.
Actually, I completely disagree.
You like the Vanguard stuff?
There are certain things that I do not like. So I find that like if there's a particular thing that I want to do, like for me, a couple of times a year, I'll do like I need to know on a year-to-date basis how much I've actively contributed into a fund. It's I'm always like, oh, where do I click? But I can get to it. Whereas most sites just make it incredibly difficult, and then you end up having to like add up every transaction by transaction. Well, I'm dollar cost averaging twice a month. Like, I don't want to add. I don't want to add up like 16 lines. Come on, that is too much to ask. The other thing that I think Vanguard does is they actually will strip out your contributions from your rate of return, which is incredibly unusual. Most sites will not. They will show you a rate of return. Let's say it's your for your 401k, but it will include, you know, the 10,000 or the 18,000 that you put in of your own cash.
Right.
That's not really a rate of return. That's called a contribution.
So go to the Vanguard site and you tell us what you think.
Tell us what you think.
Is Steve right or Monica right? And we know that two of the three of us have some money to invest. All right. And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the very interesting story behind it. Steve?
I'll go first. Sure. So my number is 75. 75 is the number of banks that have joined J.P. Morgan's cross-border blockchain-powered project. It's interesting because, you know, we all know that remittances are a huge market. Billions of dollars leave the U.S. and go to places like Mexico and the Philippines and so on and so forth. And so J.P. Morgan has created this program called the Interbank Information Network. But if you look at the actual members, the member banks of this program, it's interesting because they're all kind of smaller banks, sort of non-primary institutions. So it's very small. Like it's like the third largest bank in Bolivia, and like a third-rate bank in Korea. So it's sort of a way to
After the first like four or something like, because it's Societe Generale and Santander, and then it goes. It takes a big leap down after that.
I think after the first four or five founding members, the rest are just like secondary or even tertiary banks.
Well, with that many, it's still
a lot, yeah. But it's like the Bank of Montreal as opposed to RBS.
RBC.
Or RBC, yeah.
I see that they're using their own blockchain called Quorum. So no help at all to you Ethereum blockchain EOS investors. They have a completely separate blockchain of their own. It's not clear that they'll want or even need a cryptocurrency with this blockchain. It's not a requirement, right?
It's not. It may just be cross-border payments powered by the blockchain.
Yeah. Well, this is such a... Payments.
And I do want to be clear. It's Quorum spelled with a Q, not...
A C-H.
Quorum or Quorum.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That was from my article. Chorum.
Yeah, so there are, they sound very alike, and we are talking about two different entities.
I'm going to start something called Litecoin.
Litecoin?
And Methereum soon. So, you know, this kind of points out that blockchain and cryptocurrencies, those were supposed to be the answers on their own to solve international payments. But I think this and so many requirements and making it consumer friendly, there's so many more things that need to be done besides just having the blockchain.
Nothing like a little competitive pressure to make banks think like, wait, we don't know who's actually going to get that part of the pie, so we better find a way to do it.
Yeah. And the Bitcoin volatility hasn't made it something you feel comfortable to send to another country. And so they're bringing that stability that that Bitcoin wanted to get rid of, really, right?
We should do in the future an episode on how cryptocurrencies are used in countries where the economy is not ideal, so like Argentina and Venezuela and you know, Iran, maybe.
Oh, you just mentioned my investment portfolio.
Well, there you go. North Korea as well, sure.
The North Korea coin, yeah. Yeah, and there's a New York coin, right?
I've seen photos, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So our next final bite is Monica.
Yeah.
A big number, right? Come on, give us a big number, Monica.
It's the lowest integer possible. Is that true? Can integers be negative?
Positive. The lowest positive. The lowest positive integer.
All right. Yeah. The number is one. And it is the number of U.S. states that are exploring using blockchain for voting.
Is it California?
It is not. It is the state of West Virginia.
Wow. California.
West Virginia is wants to use blockchain technology to support overseas voting. And in a distressing trend.
Not domestic voting, not in the U.S., international voting.
No, overseas voting. So West Virginia,
and people outside of the U.S.
This actually isn't specified in the article, but West Virginia has a pretty high proportion of their citizens in the armed services, and so overseas voting is something that's really important for service members. But what I was going to say, in a distressing trend where I think we're going to have to spell out every name of every goofily named company, West Virginia is partnering with VOATZ, V-O-A-T-Z.
Okay, that's no confusion there.
Not at all.
Yeah, is that the Russian spelling?
So VOATZ allows overseas voters to register for their app by uploading a selfie and their photo ID, and they do have to go through a multi-factor authentication process to log in. And so theoretically, you'd do all that, and then you'd have your ballot, and you'd like input your votes, and boom, send. It's on the blockchain. It's unchangeable. However, there are some doubters, and I would like to quote one of them. Joseph Lorenzo Hall, who is the chief technologist at the Center for Democracy and Technology, he's quoted as telling CNN, "It's internet voting on people's horribly secured devices over our horrible networks to servers that are very difficult to secure without a physical paper record of the vote." Now, I don't necessarily disagree with him, but I also see that there might be some ways to mitigate some of that over time. But VOATZ developers have said that the app can detect if malware has infected a device and will only run on particular smartphone models that have the latest security updates. We'll see.
So two things in that. Don't Estonians vote on blockchain right now?
I feel like I've read something about that, but I don't know any of the details.
Okay. And the other one is that I've heard that if you want to prevent hacking by nefarious actors in the election, embrace paper voting, because that's
I'm totally down.
Much less likely to be hacked than
and any you have an auditable thing. Record. And I think that's
right,
one of
a physical record that can be altered easily, at least.
Exactly. I think that's one of the concerns here is that, well, once you get it to the blockchain, it might be immutable, but can it be edited and changed and misrepresented before it gets to the blockchain? And on
after.
Our horribly secured devices, on our horrible networks, it probably could.
Yeah, still a lot of issues. All right. Well, my final number is 5. And I'm sorry, it's not a happy number. It's the number of people that have died from E. coli contamination in the first part of 2018.
Is this a blockchain number?
This is a blockchain number. So as a result of that and the other 200 people that were infected from E. coli that happened in the United States and everywhere, these things have to get traced back to their source as quickly as possible so they can identify what happened and which items to pull. And sometimes some company like Walmart might have to pull like or destroy 100 tons mm-hmm. of lettuce or tomatoes
Spinach, sure.
or whatever it is so because they don't know, they don't have traceability. So now Walmart and its division Sam's Club are going to require that suppliers of leafy greens to start with mm-hmm. Start using a blockchain tech in order to track their shipments through the Walmart supply chain. And it's a big win for IBM. They're the ones supplying the system,
well,
this blockchain-based system, in order to track this. So this is their first item. In the next few years, they're going to require more and more of their produce and perishable goods to be tracked through blockchain-based technology. And what this does is it makes it very quick because the blockchain tracks every point along the provenance. The provenance is the source. So every step along the provenance is scanned at small groupings. And so they can track an individual item, you know, where it's been through the time it was grown to the time it gets sold to a customer.
And it's great that they're starting with salad greens because this actually is a repeated source of E. coli outbreaks in the U.S. You know, we've had numerous people, more than five over the last 5 years or so, die from different outbreaks from romaine, spinach. So I think this is really good news. And this is way more exciting to me than another ICO.
Well, yeah, this is a direct health thing. So they did a test, actually. To prove to Walmart that this would actually be helpful. So they had Walmart track back a certain amount of sliced mangoes back to the source and see how long it took them to find out where that package came from. And it took them 7 days to do it through searching through all their paperwork. Just imagine mountains of boxes of paperwork they have to go through at each step of the way and find these things. So it took them 7 days. And then
without blockchain technology.
Without blockchain, yeah, through the paper and pencil method that they have now. And so IBM demonstrated that they could track it in 2 seconds. And as soon as they said, oh, that carton, it just came back with the answer. And you could see every step along the way of where that had been and who handled it and packaged it and everything about it.
Very cool.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll change our final bite to zero people dying from E. coli for next year. That's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Thanks for joining and hit subscribe to keep up with our latest episodes. Please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com for any questions, comments, or any topics that you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye for now.